Dave, you face a series of challenges as you approach your home airport. You got crosswinds, you got low ceiling, visibility, a lot going on. For a single pilot IFR, might this bring a lot of pilots to the breaking point where this just doesn't make sense?
I think so, and I think that the main thing for just given human nature is we all want to get home. We're almost there. We're willing to take on just about anything just to get sleep in our own bed tonight and put the plane in its hangar. So, I mean, that's to me, that's the greatest temptation. And I'm at the end of a trip, and it's like, I just want to get home. I'm almost there.
And I'm wondering, you know, last leg, I mean, how many accidents occur on last leg to the home airport? The level of analysis that it took for you to decide exactly what you're going to do, some of that really would have had to start on the ground before takeoff, would it not?
I think so, and I think that that you know, there's a even though this is an ILS and all ILSs are essentially the same, you know, there's a certain comfort factor that comes in flying an ILS that we've flown many times before, and certainly just given the ways of pilots that we're we're more likely to fly an ILS and fly it more aggressively and fly it all the way down to DH at our home drum.
The other question that comes up is this sin vision, because you're, you know, predicating a lot of your decision-making based upon the sin vision. Might that be a distraction if you didn't have the level of experience in it that your pilot has in it? Say it's relatively new to your airplane. How much dependence do you put upon a new tool without getting the practice you talked about getting in it?
That's a tough one, because it's like we have so many great technological tools, and they're only great if they're working for us. And it seems like so often they're, you know, we're at working at cross purposes. And you can see how an instrument scan, when you're hand flying an ILS in gusty conditions, that requires about all the brain power I've got. You know, is this going to further tax it? And in my opinion, it doesn't take long to get used to synthetic vision, and it makes it simpler. And what really ends up happening is that synthetic vision almost becomes primary, and your other instruments are supporting. You know, we can talk about whether that's a good idea or not, given this the non-certified nature of this product. In my own limited experience, I've found that synthetic vision helps. It's a bigger help than it is a hindrance.
Jeff, what are your thoughts?
You know, there are two discussions here that I think are both relevant. One is about the synthetic vision, and one is about the approach itself. I'm not even sure which one to start with. Both start with synthetic vision. I think it's a mistake to say all synthetic vision is the same thing. You know, you talk about synthetic vision being primary, and if we're talking about a certified synthetic vision system with a flight path marker that is absolutely accurate, you know what? Even if technically it shouldn't be primary, it's amazing how well it works. And it really does work to put the flight path marker where you want to go and then verify the needles are still centered. You know what? Every time you look at those needles, they're still centered, right? But we're not talking about a certified synthetic vision system here. We are talking about an iPad. And I think there is a danger in lumping those two together. Yeah, it's definitely accurate. But exactly how accurate? It's a Stratus, so it's got actual pressure altitude instead of GPS altitude, except if that sensor fails, there's no way for you to know. The iPad will just revert to saying, oh, here's your GPS altitude. And the picture it's giving you, where it thinks you are, and where that runway is, that's all based off of GPS position, which now has an inherent error. And now down in those last couple hundred feet, a couple hundred feet of error is a huge error. So I think there's a real trap there in keeping all of these the same.
Well, yeah, I'd like to back up on Dave's comment about practicing. I have in my airplane almost the identical setup as our scenario pilot, the Stratus. I have my iPad mounted on the yoke. I recently made two low approaches. The first one resulted in a miss. The second one landed, and I was embarrassed to say I never even looked at the synthetic vision. It just wasn't part of my scan. And because it was 3 feet or 2 feet closer to me than the instrument panel, and frankly, Dave, as you pointed out, I was so busy flying the instruments that I just didn't see it. So your suggestion of going out and practicing with an observer pilot is good. I think also to what Jeff said, there's a big difference between a G1000 with synthetic vision right on the panel where you have all your other data. Some guys mount their iPad over on the right side. Some guys have it up on the ceiling. Some guys have it in their lap. And I think each one of those installations is unique and needs its own evaluation.
Wally, I agree with you on this. I think it is my opinion that unless the synthetic vision is truly primary or built into the system, it's a distraction here, unless perhaps the pilot has a great deal of experience with it. But in my case, I would say this is a simple approach. It's an ILS. Do the ILS. If you want to maybe glance at that synthetic vision occasionally, fine, but fly the approach. Don't become distracted. The issue here is it's very tempting when you get into this synthetic vision now to project the circle to land. It's very tempting. Circle to land is inherently a problem to start with without bringing in another element, another perspective on it. I think we're just asking for trouble there. I would stay with the ILS, fly the ILS. The ILS, in this case, I think may do the job for you. This is a Part 91 operation. Fly it down to DH and look out the window and see what's there.
I've never flown SynthViz myself. However, I've flown with numerous pilots that have SynthViz, whether it's G1000, Aspen, or on the ForeFlight. My experience with these pilots, and again, I haven't flown it myself, you talk about the flight path marker, and I watch that flight path marker just dance around the runway. It's kind of circles it, but it doesn't nail it. I do know that when I fire up a GPS, whether it's me firing mine or my clients with me, I'm asked to identify two things before I can actually use the GPS. One is that the database is correct, and that the needles are working properly, that the D-bar is half left, the V-bar is half up, the flags are there, and that the course indicator is there, because that's what the TSO is. I've never, ever seen anything that tests the flight path marker. Am I going to trust my life to something that I haven't tested?
That's a fair point, absolutely. But, you know, even getting back to the approach itself, I wouldn't fly the ILS approach. And again, I want to back up a little bit in something Dave said that, you know, it is true. An ILS is an ILS is an ILS, except when it isn't. So this one, we have a high DA, right? A high decision altitude. Regardless of why, if we're at, say, 400 AGL, we're approximately 8,000 feet from the touchdown point, 1,000 feet down the runway. So we're 7,000 feet from the threshold. This is an ODALS for the approach lights. So what's that, 1,400 feet long. We have a mile of visibility, a statute mile, 5,000 feet. So wait a minute, 7,000 feet minus 5,000 feet. We can see to a point, if the visibility was reported correctly, about 2,000 feet short of the runway, or about 600 feet short of the first white light of the approach lights. I don't think this approach is going to do it for you. I think you're going to waste your time flying down the ILS, see nothing, and have to go missed. And that's why I like the option of flying the localizer approach. Now, I am with you, Dave, on that. Flying the localizer approach, by the time I see the lights, I'm going to be high. But now, my non-certified synthetic vision, to me, is a real benefit. I do know where to look for the runway. I do know the picture that I'm shooting for. And I'm anticipating that this is going to be a steep descent. It's only about a, 400-foot difference that I've got to make up for. And I've got about 7 knots of headwind component. So this should be doable. And that's, to me, that's a great way to leverage the synthetic vision without using it to go beyond where DA is, because I feel like, you know, I'm going to come down to DA. I can see the runway on synthetic vision. I know all I have to do on the ILS is breathe for a couple more seconds, and I should start seeing one white light and another white light of that ODALS. I also don't like that it's not like an ALSF or something that really guides me to the runway. So that's why I like the localizer more.
We talked about situational awareness, and we've been referring to that throughout the whole discussion here. And really, that's the key. I mean, where are we and where do my hazards lie? And you know, both, and as we transition from IFR to VFR, you know, there's a lot of challenges here. And I think we have to ask ourselves here, you know, Dave had the pilot coming back to his home airport, familiarity, comfortable in the airplane, and some pretty good experience. You take a pilot that has any lesser skills, qualifications, it might be a whole different decision process that leads us to an entirely different outcome. So once again, you know, one size does not fit all. And we don't want to, you know, tell everybody that, you know, if you have CINVision, you know, this is going to carry you to a place where, you know, you can take on this challenge. This challenge might be a little bit more than, you know, an average pilot might be willing to sustain on that night.
I think we need to make it clear as part of this discussion that the synthetic vision, and you made it clear, Dave, in your response, but we need to reiterate the fact that the synthetic vision does not allow you any reduction of minimums. And so in this case, if you were to do the ILS and not have a mile of or a mile and a half of in-flight visibility, you'd still be obligated to do a missed approach.
Dan, I wanted to talk about that too. You know, technically you're shooting this approach below minimums. It requires a mile and a half, and we're reporting a mile. And if you compared this to a for-hire operation versus a Part 135, you couldn't even start that approach.
That's correct. But we're 91 in this case.
We're 91. So, you know, does that give us are we operating to a lower standard than a for-hire operation?
Yeah.
One of the things, yeah, we are. And, you know, another thing about a for-hire operation, 135, 121, which I kind of like is that there's no personal minimums. The minimums are all specified in the op spec. Crosswind, maximum crosswind, all this stuff. It would be very easy to apply your own version of an op spec against this to really objectively determine whether or not you can make this approach. And, you know, it, obviously I think you would be able to make the localizer approach given that if you were flying with 135, but you couldn't even start the ILS. And using that as a benchmark against personal minimums would be kind of interesting.
Right. And just sort of true confessions, it's like it wouldn't even occur to me to fly the localizer approach, if I'm coming in at night and ILS 23 is advertised, it's like that's what I'm loading, that's what I'm flying. It wouldn't even I wouldn't even notice. And so the point about practicing with the CINVIS, I think that's critical. And I've actually done it, you know, with a safety pilot in the airplane and the windshield totally opaque. And we were able to. I mean, we went to Martinsburg, which is a gigantic, you know, runway, but it's like time after time, we're able to not just fly to minimums. We're able to land the airplane and do it within 10 feet of the center line using CINVIS alone. So it's, you know, guaranteed. We all know that the caveats, but it's like, it's a tremendously powerful tool that inspires great confidence.
I don't deny that it's a great tool, but I really get worried about this practicing with it. It's just like we supposedly teach 00 takeoffs. What does that teach the learner? That it's okay to take off when it's 00. Why do we even teach it? Okay. The same thing here. I've seen many pilots. It's an LNAV plus V. Okay, we're going to follow that glide slope right down to the 1,000-foot marker. It works every time. So if I get to the MDA, well, I still got the glide, and I don't see anything. I can keep on coming down, and they forget that the lateral sensitivity is nowhere near as great as it would be on an LPV. And I'll come back again. Does that synth viz give that kind of accuracy? And we're fooling ourselves if we say we can really fly it right to the runway. In an emergency, maybe.
But this discussion is so reminiscent of don't give pilots weather in the cockpit or they'll fly too close to the thunderstorms. I mean, let's give ourselves the best tools we possibly can, and then, you know,
it's like when we first had handheld GPSs, right? You know,
again, I think there's a real danger in lumping everything together as one kind of thing. I'm curious, Dave, when you flew that CINVIS to the runway, what were you flying and what was the system you were flying?
Let's see, it was Garmin Pilot on an iPad in a 182.
Okay, so it was just a... And what was driving the iPad?
GDL39.
Okay, and a portable receiver. So that is, you know, a non-certified system, and it has none of the inherent error checking that I was talking... That, you know, Doug brought up and I was talking about before. And to me, it's great that it worked out for you. I could conceive of a situation where it was horribly off. And I think that happens in a lot of places where, you know, people don't realize how thin the layer of protection is on you know, a portable system because it works so well most of the time. Another really good example is traffic. You know, people talk about, oh, I've got traffic on my iPad, right, from my Stratus receiver, and this is terrific. Well, again, it works great as long as the receiver that's driving it has pressure altitude. If it doesn't, then all your traffic suddenly can be off by 100, 200, even 300 feet because the iPad's using your GPS altitude, but it's receiving from ADS-B somebody else's pressure altitude. And so, hey, that guy's not a problem. I'm looking for him, but he's 300 feet above me. Actually, he isn't. He's at your altitude.
It's great to know the limitations of the equipment, but it's like, come on, if the traffic is 100 feet off, it's still really useful information to have.
Agreed. It's still really useful to have, but how much are you willing to rely on it? Like in this case, you know, seeing your position coming down to the runway, 100 feet, 300, 400 feet above the ground is a big difference as to where you are.
Right, but it's like, you know, the iPad test was out of curiosity for an emergency situation. You lost total electrical power. Can you find the airport and land? To me, these are great tools to incorporate, and we can incorporate them in ways that don't overtax us.
This scenario was a very, very challenging situation. It brought in a lot of factors, both human factors and aircraft-related issues, but the proper use of tools that provides us the very, very best situational awareness will lead us to our best choice.